This is Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, the changing face of black leadership, part two, the new militancy in the NAACP. Tonight's guest, Chester Lewis, who led the revolt of the Young Turks at the NAACP convention. You speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Collect Night Call's national phone number, area code 212-749-3311, or in the New York area, 866-5010. Night Call's host in New York City is Del Shields.
Good evening. We continue our week-long look at the changing face of black leadership. Last night, the Reverend Jesse Jackson told how the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is now directing its major efforts to black boycotts of white-owned ghetto businesses. Tonight, we examine another civil rights organization, the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and take a look at the reasoning behind the revolt of the Young Turks at their recent annual convention. Our guest tonight led that revolt. He is Chester Lewis. He and 200 other delegates who agreed with him walked out of that convention because, he said, the present leadership of the NAACP is, and we quote, just an appendage of the white power structure and cannot free black people in America, unquote. Mr. Lewis's group, the National Committee to Revitalize the NAACP, also says that organization is unresponsive and irrelevant to the needs of the 15 million blacks who live in the ghettos of the cities. Other specific criticisms made by Mr. Lewis and his group, that the NAACP did not mount a national protest when Representative Adam Clayton Powell was denied his seat in Congress, and that they also did not mount a national protest when the heavyweight boxing title was taken away from Muhammad Ali. What Mr. Lewis's group apparently wants is what they call a more militant and more enlightened role for the NAACP. In answer to this protest move, Executive Director Roy Wilkins had a resolution passed that the historic policies of the association should be and are hereby reaffirmed. The recently encountered pressures to abandon democratic processes are rejected, and sows of discord and dissension and advocates of threats and terror within our ranks are repudiated. The convention also embraced, for the first time in the history of the NAACP, a mild concept of black power, defining it as black control of their schools and black ownership of the ghetto economy. But in his major speech of the convention, Mr. Wilkins attacked racial unity, racial pride, racial identity, and said advocates of those concepts would plunge us backward into the artificial separation, the strangeness, the hatred, the jealousies, conflict, and envy of the dark years from which we are beginning to emerge. At any rate, the Young Turks did walk out. Mr. Wilkins did say he was disturbed, and Mr. Lewis has resigned as president of the Wichita, Kansas branch of the NAACP and as Kansas State legal counsel to the NAACP, and has also asked that his name be removed from the rolls of NAACP life membership. Mr. Lewis is standing by in Wichita to answer your questions and share your comments and conversation about the changing face of black power. You may talk to him direct by calling our national phone number, which is area code 212-749-3311. You may, of course, call us collect. National calls at 212-749-3311. In the New York area, call us at 866-5010. That's local calls on 866-5010. Mr. Lewis, good evening.
Good evening, Shields. How are you?
Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
A week or so, Mr. Lewis, former Vice President Nixon said he would not resign from a country club that practiced racial segregation in its membership policies, that he would instead seek to change those policies from inside as a member of the organization. Do you really think you can be more effective in changing the policies with the NAACP from outside the organization?
Well, in reply to that, had I thought so, Dell, I would not have resigned. Along with the so-called Young Turks or pro-blacks within the NAA, fought this thing out for 5 or 6 years. Up until 2 years ago, we had a strenuous battle. We had it won until the United Auto Workers under the auspices of Walter Reuther intervened with their staff and money, and most of us drew a conclusion. in Atlantic City that it was hopeless and therefore could not be revitalized, and if we were going to be relevant to the needs of the black community, we had to get out of the NAA.
Is it an ideological struggle that's going on, or is it a situation where many of the people who are presently in charge of the NAACP, who have been there for a number of years, kind of see their position being threatened?
Well, of course, as you know, Del, all things are multiple. I don't belong to the school of thought that there are simplistic answers for everything. Primarily, however, the situation is ideological. The ideological genesis is that those of us in the Young Turks have come to a point of view which is more or less the young black point of view across the nation, that the only salvation for black people in America is viable black power. Now, black power to some of the older, most of the older leaders in NAA frightens them. I think Mr. Wilkins used terms like black death and apartheid. We talk about regaining racial pride, and they look upon us as though we're a bunch of racists. Even when moderate white people are beginning to see semblance and rationale to black power, the old guard and NAA still think it's some kind of black Ku Klux Klanism.
The struggle of the Young Turks has been going on for the past 5 or 6 years, as you said earlier. Now, 5 years ago, when you first began this, I'm going to call it assault on the old guard, were the issues the same as they were today?
Well, 5 years ago, of course, the issues were not that clearly drawn. Our group have always stated that the battle of the 20th century in terms of freedom, liberation of black people, lies in the urban ghettos of the North, you see, not in the rural areas of the South. We have always stated that until the North itself exorcises racism, hate, etc., first, the South cannot do so. Of course, the national office specifically cued in on the South because as long as they could go after Southern white racists who lynched black people and shot them down at midnight, they could always get Northern white support in volume. But once we turn our attention to the hypocrisy and the white racism that lies as not only dormant but active and pregnant in northern communities, we begin to lose close to white liberal and moderate support that we heretofore had when we had our guns trained elsewhere.
In view of the fact that self-determination and the new embracing of black philosophy that has been in evidence by black people throughout the country, do you feel that the NAACP is outdated?
Well, in my own humble opinion, the civil rights movement is dead. The NAACP being the not only the architect, but the present symbolic image of the civil rights movement, therefore would make the NAACP, let me say this. The NAACP is dead because the civil rights movement is dead. Because for a number of reasons, that the mimeograph machines, typewriters, the court suits, and legislation, and the programming by whites and the blacks hasn't materially affected the depressed and impoverished condition of the bulk of blacks in this country.
You mentioned that the NAACP did not take a stand on Adam Clayton Powell's dismissal from Congress. What would you have liked to have seen the NAACP do?
Well, first let me say this. The reason that the present leadership did not take a stand behind Powell was because the white leadership in Washington didn't want them to, number one. Number two, the present national NAACP leadership has always thought A. Clayton Powell was a radical, very frankly, that he talked too much about blackness and negritude and racial unity and racial pride and racial identity. The three areas of concern, as you noticed, that Mr. Wilkins addressed himself to at the Atlantic City Convention. And therefore, I think the feeling was among top NAA leadership that he got what he had coming, very frankly.
Whitney Young, in his role as the executive secretary or director of the Urban League, made a statement, and he stated that change is sometimes painful for an organization, but without change, it is sometimes fatal. Now, inasmuch as Mr. Young has come out and embrace the philosophy of black power, does this mean that the NAACP is further pushed into the conservative area?
Well, the speech you have reference to was Whitney's speech at the Core Convention. As you know, Mr. Young is under considerable pressure in that his whole establishment is financed, the white establishment, as you know. And at least he has the guts and the fortitude to recognize what's going on in black America and the needs of the black community. Now, this leaves NAA as the only civil rights organization that's still running away from being black. Tragically, 10 years ago, when I came in, at least I've been working in NAA almost 5 years, people thought that we laughed at the Urban League because they were bought and paid for by the white power structure and they were irrelevant and so forth. They wouldn't take a stand on issues. Now, NAA has become the most conservative, most responsible, the most moderate, the most backward organization in existence. And this is one reason that that gave sustenance and stability and thrust to the Young Turk movement in NAA.
In view of the fact that NAACP has led the fight in the legal arena, is it not possible that the old guard would feel somewhat satisfied that they have done their job and done their job well?
Well, of course, they think that they're still relevant, you see. They feel that bringing blacks and ones and twos into our society is meaningful. They feel that appointing middle-class blacks to key positions in government is a great step forward. They aren't geared toward mass thinking, you see. They're geared toward the old kind of what I call tokenation, which they call integration, you see.
Mr. Lewis, we'll begin taking some calls from our night call listeners across the nation, and standing by, we have listeners in Oregon and in Indiana, as well as in New York City. But first, our national telephone numbers are area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. That's our national telephone number. And remember, we welcome your calls collect, as well as your comments and your conversation. Our local telephone number in New York is 866-5010. Mr. Lewis, we'll take our first call from Lake Oswego, Oregon. Mr. Smets is hearing night call over KLIQ-FM. Your call, Mr. Smets.
Yes, sir. I'm very interested in your comments about the NAACP being dead, because I don't think it is at all. I also think, in brief, that most of the problems of the Negro movement are in the East and in the South, and not necessarily in the West, so to speak. It seems like all the problems, actually, of our society are in the East. I was just wondering, isn't your movement really a power movement within your own race, so to speak?
Well, it's not really a power movement within our own race. First, let me correct you. There are as many problems in Oregon as there are any place else in the Deep South. They may not have the surface racist character.
No, there are no killings up here like down in the South. There are no killings like in Cincinnati or Detroit.
Well, of course, it's not a matter of killings. It's a matter that the blacks in Oregon are still on the bottom rung of the ladder. They still are hired last, fired first, still are barred.
Not necessarily. I have to correct you as you go along, because these people are working in the best department stores, and they're certainly getting their fair share.
Well, of course, the statistics would disprove that. Even
not out here.
Well, I know about Portland, and I know about Olympia and some other places in Oregon, like I know about Tacoma and Seattle. There isn't a city in America where a black man is free, and just because they aren't being lynched or shot doesn't mean that you're free. Sometimes the fact that there's overt violence awakens people to the need. But,
well, he's not in chains.
In answering your question, certainly it was a power play. If a person has strong enough conviction that he wants to change the policy of an organization, unless he wants to do so, he has to work to change the political base, unless you're going to be naive.
Are you suggesting that I'm naive?
No, I'm suggesting that you have you're like an ostrich with your head in the sand if you say Oregon has no problem.
Well, I could suggest that your head might be in the sand, too, and I just wonder what your motive might be.
Well, what I'm saying is Oregon is no different than any other state in this country. I've traveled all over the country. All statistics show, from governmental reports on the way to all the way down.
So have I. I was in Greensboro when this thing first started.
That in Oregon, I bet you that the average white person with an eighth grade education makes more money than the average black who graduates from the University of Oregon. Now, this is all over the country, so...
Is this your only criterion?
No, it's not the only criteria. That's only one example, and I could give you a ream of them that go on and on and on.
How would you solve this? How would you say a Negro can get more income than he's getting when compared to a University of Oregon graduate?
Well, what I'm saying is no, you misunderstood me. What I'm saying is the average white person with an eighth grade education in Oregon, in Kansas, in Pennsylvania, New York, junior high school dropout, has more income than the average black from an integrated college who has a degree. These are facts.
Are you saying that the Negro has made absolutely no gains in the last 5 years in spite of all the debt that they've suffered and these rates riots and so on?
Well, when you say gains, I would say everything is comparative. In comparison to the overall, the economy has moved forward much faster than so-called black gains. Therefore, that's the reason we find that even despite the greatest affluence in our history, black unemployment rates are still operating at depression levels, at rates double those for whites.
Well, let me make this point. There are more poor white people in this country than there are poor Negroes. This is a fact.
Well, of course, there are 10 times as many. Therefore, there ought to be 10 times as many poor white people, and yet there are only 2 times as many.
Mr. Schmitz, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, and Mr. Lewis, we're having a bit of a problem with your line. We're going to ask you to hang up, and we're going to try to call you back as we depart for station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Chester Lewis after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
Large numbers of black people in this country are coming to the point where almost no action, violent or nonviolent, legal or illegal, is looked upon as being the sort of action that will help. And I think that's a dangerous point for us, where we reach the point where nothing is likely to help us. And it means, I think, almost the beginning of suicide.
Julian Bond, a black politician, is pessimistic, and a white ethics professor has faith.
I don't agree. We're all upset. In spite of the many faults of the white people, I think there's a strong reservoir of compassion in a lot of white people in this country and a strong desire to see that the black man does get his right.
These voices, plus your own voice of question or comment, are Night Call. Speak for yourself.
Mr. Lewis, we are back once again on Night Call, and we're very sorry we were having some trouble with your line from this end, and I think that this will be a better one for us.
Are you straightened out now?
Yes, we're straightened out, and you're sounding beautiful.
Thank you.
We'll take our next call from Indianapolis, Indiana. Mr. Uh-huh. William Hardy is hearing Night Call over WTLC-FM. Your call, Mr. Hardy.
Yes, Chet?
Yes.
This is Bill Hardy. How are you doing?
Hello, Bill. How are you doing?
All right. I'm pleased to hear your voice over WTLC tonight. And I just wanted you to know that I agree 100% with your program. As you know, I'm a past regional director of the NAACP.
I know you are.
And I left, as you know. I'm now a businessman. And doggone it, we need some black leadership, and I'm glad to hear you talk the way you are. I watched your performance at the convention. I was sorry that I couldn't be there to assist.
Uh-huh.
At this point, what is your program for the black businessman in the ghetto? And my philosophy has always been that, doggone it, if I don't have enough money as the white guy on the other side of the table, then, you know, we can't deal together. I can't get anything out of him, and he certainly would not deal with me if I don't have as much. So what is your plan for the black businessman in this country?
Well, I would certainly agree that as even an integral part of black power, what I call viable, pregnant black power,
uh-huh,
means that the white power structure, we might as well face facts, is not going to yield one thing in this country until they are confronted by independent political and economic power.
Right.
Because only power speaks to power in this country, and of course, we're the only race of people, as opposed to other ethnic groups who came to this country only ask for justice. We're always asking for love. We're always continually, as Senator Harris from Oklahoma, who spoke at our convention in Atlantic City,
mm-hmm,
ask us to continue to shock the conscience of the nation. In other words, we're always supposed to appeal to a sense of morality instead of getting our bag together and coming into this society horizontally. Now, I have a plan and a program, too, for economic
uplift.
Right.
I think, number one, that black folks ought to initiate financial combines to control all commercial and retail businesses in the ghetto.
That's right.
That we ought to form, a national mutual fund with subordinate state and local counterparts to raise millions of dollars, say, for instance, to buy 10% of the stock in Montgomery Wards or Sears and Roebuck.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to cancel insurance policies and investments in white-owned companies and reinvest these in black businesses, even at a, quote, loss. We ought to form supermarkets, savings and loan companies, banks, mortgage companies. And last of all, we ought to finance our own civil rights movement.
That's right.
And that's the reason we're shaky now. We're never sure whether or not some foundation may call on a telephone and say, look, boy, no more money tomorrow. See?
Mm-hmm. Now, you're not saying that we should do all of this so that we could sell to black only, or you think we could sell to everybody, the total market, am I right?
No, see, what I'm saying is that first we have to exercise power under some umbrella, you see.
Uh-huh.
In order to be integrated, and I use the word integrated with a parenthetical sense, you know, integration to the old leaders means token bits of black and oceans of salt and institution control of white people.
Mm-hmm.
When I say integration, I mean that the 22 million blacks in this country, and this is our country, we've done more for it than anybody else, that we want to get our thing together in terms of an economic base so that we can come in as equals and compete as equals, you see.
Right.
Because, you know, integration of inferiors and superiors is colonialism. And that's what we have pretty much now in Indianapolis and Wichita and Kansas City. You know, this talk of separatism, we didn't cause ghettos around this country. This nation is separated between black and white, not due to the black man's fault. All we're saying is that in Indianapolis, at least black folks ought to control the black ghetto.
That's right. Well, I agree with you 100%.
And then it doesn't mean that this is our ultimate aim. This is only a transitory aim so we can gain enough confidence in controlling our own affairs to make it possible for us to be meaningful in this so-called integrated society.
I see. What is your opinion for this coming election? What seems to be the outcome, in your opinion, now?
Well, I take this position that until black folks get some independent political power, it doesn't really matter who's elected president.
Uh-huh.
And I mean that. And therefore, I am not really active behind any candidate. I used to be a strong Humphrey man 4 years ago. I was a delegate to the Democratic National Convention. But his position on the Vietnam War has sickened me to the point where if he was nominated, I could not even vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
But I do lean toward McCarthy, but if McCarthy's going to the Democratic National Convention, and then after he loses, embraces Humphrey in a great spirit of Comrade A, then I can't go with him, you know, because I've come to the school of thought that I'm sick and tired of choosing between the lesser of the two evils, between twiddly dumb and twiddly D, that all we get is a few more crumbs from one as opposed to the other, and we need to organize independent political bases whereby we can be meaningful. Now, George Wallace's third party, say what you want to, is composed of some of the worst people in this country.
That's true.
But they're making themselves felt, even though they are a minority, because they're together, and they're coming into this thing horizontally rather than being swallowed up by either the big parties who would ignore them.
Well, do you have any plan for all of the black people and people who are sympathetic with us to come together to form this black base? Is this going to be with the Young Turk movement, or are we going to take over the NAACP, or what is the plan now?
Well, the plan is, within the next few weeks, we've been doing a lot of discussing already, as you may well recognize.
Right.
And there is considerable confusion. There are some people in the Turk movement who still think there's hope in taking over control of NAA.
Mm-hmm.
None of us feel that there's anything NAA is doing is relevant. I mean, that's a foregone conclusion. Its present posture is irrelevant. In fact, almost an insult to the black community, to be very honest about it. That we're talking with people all over with reference to SCLC, in CORE, in SNCC, and there are a lot of pro-black groups across the country. There are black student groups. In my area, almost every university campus has a strong black student group, maybe trying to get the leadership together for the next 30 days to talk about some kind of united front nationally. Because, as you know, Bill, the trouble with black leadership, between poverty programs, which is now the post office of the civil rights movement, there's so many brothers on local, state, and federal payrolls that they can't be too meaningful to their black brothers because of a conflict of interest. You know what I'm
talking about. That's right. That's right. They've been bought off.
Our leadership has been bought and paid for. We can't speak out. A lot of good men, you know a lot of them, I do too.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them who went into these jobs thinking that I could get inside and change things, got inside and got swallowed up, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many of us, and to me it's the greatest thing that ever happened in this country, is that finally black folks have turned black, we've looked back to our heritage, we've decided to put our toothpicks together and get a battering ram and knock down this door of racism in this country.
Well,
Mr. Hardy, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being with us. This is Night Call in New York. Our guest tonight, Mr. Chester Lewis, calling in from Wichita, Kansas. Our next call is a local call here in New York, Mr. John Williams, who is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Your question, Mr. Williams.
Hello, Mr. Lewis.
Yes.
Yes, I was listening to the first call, and I think it's kind of ridiculous for white people to try to confuse black people with the idea that white people in the South are different
right.
from white people in the North.
Right.
When actually, racism in the North is much more damaging and deadlier than racism in the South when you look at it, because in the North it's hidden.
Right.
And it's harder and it's more difficult to fight an enemy that you cannot see, and that one that you do not know where it is going to attack. Like in the South, the black people in the South, they have been showed many times over, you know, how white people feel about them, and they know how to react to different situations. But as in the North, white people are constantly keeping their racism hidden, and it only comes out at certain points, and then at these times, our people are not ready for it, and they do not know how to react to it.
Very true.
And my second point was, I was thinking, when I look around and I see a lot of the uprisings that our people are involved in, and a lot of our people that are going to jail, and a lot of our people who are in difficulty with the system, like Huey Newton out on the West Coast, and different brothers and sisters who have been arrested and provoked. I was wondering what was the reasons why the NAACP seems to take a non-participant attitude towards this thing, as if they're saying to, white people that, well, it's not us, it's them, don't worry, we're not involved in this. I was wondering, what is your opinion on this? Does the NAACP view themselves as a part of this?
Well, of course, the problem is that, and I say this in all candor, and I don't say it in bitterness, even the words love and hate are what I call white bag hang-ups. The issues, it doesn't matter whether you love or whether you hate. I wish they would erase these words from the dictionary. The issue is that here we are living in 1968 with 23 million black people in America, and as a race of people, a proud race of people, we are slowly disintegrating before our very eyes, and every statistic shows it in every area of concern. Now, the NAA, for years, was the only relevant force in America toward liberation and freedom of black people. But as it grew older, it grew more conservative, and now it's really an appendage to the white establishment. And I say this categorically and unequivocally, that the great apologists, you see, who run out and try to, I think one person put it, the buffer between white races and oppressed blacks.
Yes, because I was wondering, like, for instance, I know a little bit about the history of the NAACP, as far as William Lloyd Garrison, who was an abolitionist and wrote The Liberator. He was
right.
one of the first white people who were involved in the establishment of the NAACP. And I remember that William Lloyd Garrison, who was considered an abolitionist, yet condemned John Brown because he felt that John Brown was wrong in his ways of, alleviating the things that were being done to the slaves. In other words, William Lloyd Garrison would only, be for black people to a point, but when it came time for a decision to be made whether a white person's life had to be taken, he refrained from this.
Well, John Brown, is from my state, a famous hero in Kansas. The only problem is there aren't very many white folks left around like him in New York either.
Right.
Mr. Williams, thank you for calling, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Mr. Lewis, we'll return with more calls right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Chester Lewis after station identification. Call it a social pressure valve. The voice of the ghetto. The voice of disgust. The voice of hope. Call it what you will, it's the voice of the people. Night Call lets people talk, and experts on the phone anywhere in the country or world offer answers to some of the problems. Having a heart-to-heart squawk. At least it gets people talking, first about their problems and eventually to each other. Night Call has a potential cast of 200 million Americans, and we now cover 50 stations in 40 cities. It could just be the most important listening post on the air today because it starts people talking. A program you should listen to, a forum to speak for yourself. If we don't start talking to each other, we'll end up shouting, and there's no telling where we'll wind up after that. Night Call, every weeknight on this station. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Chester Lewis about the changing face of black leadership. Again, Del Shields.
And a welcome to the Night Call stations who join us for the second half hour. And our guest calling in from Wichita, Kansas, Mr. Chester Lewis, as we continue to accept more calls. Our next call will be coming from Des Moines, Iowa. Mrs. Jewell is hearing Night Call over KRNT. Your question, Mrs. Jewell. Mrs. Jewell has left us. All right, we'll go to Seattle, Washington. And Mr. McClements is hearing Night Call over KUOW-FM in Seattle. Your question, Mr. McClements.
Mr. Lewis.
Yes, Mr. McClements.
I feel as if I'm a white, middle class, but I'm extremely sympathetic and in tune, I feel, with the black cause in this country. I want to see them to enjoy their share of the wealth and the freedoms that we should all have. But I feel that, and perhaps you can set me at ease, that the black power movement is going to alienate the middle class white who is in sympathy with the black. Now, evidently he's unable to empathize with you for some reason or other, and that puts me in that category.
Let me tell you why when you get through.
Pardon?
I'll tell you why when you get through.
You will?
Yeah.
Well, there's one other thing. I don't know. Perhaps you realize that there are a good many of us that live in our own, our white middle class ghettos that have to live with people who are not at all in sympathy with what we may think. And a good many of us are not afraid to speak out.
This is true.
And as a consequence, we may suffer some form of contempt from our neighbors, and at the same time, a lack of acceptance from Negroes that we may know or work with.
Well, let me say this to you, sir. In the first place, the black power concept, let me define it very briefly. I like to define terms because different terms mean different things to different people. Black power, what I call viable, pregnant, beautiful black power, has four components. Initially, the first three are directed toward black people, the last of which is directed toward white people, all of which are integral, all of which are mutually inclusive. Unless all four are present, then none can be important. The first of which is that black people, we must first regain our sense of identity and race pride. We've been running away from being black too long. We've had the skin lighteners, the hair straighteners. Do you know the first black millionaire in this country was Madame Fuller from Chicago, who specialized in hair straighteners and skin lighteners? And it's not an accident. The self-hate, and I won't preach on it too long. We've got to rid ourselves of this diseased kind of psychological hatred we've had all these years. Then once we're able to cleanse ourselves, once we're able to, as I say, liberate ourselves within, then we can build economic power and political power on an independent base and confront this society in a way that every other power bloc has confronted it, and then therefore become meaningful. Now, in the meantime, the fourth facet, the first is identity, second is building economic power, third, political power, fourth is for white people who are genuinely sincere. And I don't mean the white missionary types. I think Baldwin said that we barely survived the last dose of white missionaryism, and we can't stand any more of it. That the missionary area for white people is not in ghettos or holding hands and singing We Shall Overcome or attending core meetings or NAA meetings. The relevancy of white people who are really sincere overseer is trying their level best to exorcise and to eradicate white hate from white communities that, for the most part, every survey, every Gallup poll, every Newsweek poll, every Roper poll has shown to be that most white communities, without exception, are racist and anti-black. Therefore, what we're saying is the missionary area for white people is in white communities, getting rid of white racism there. Now, these four components are absolutely essential. Now, the reason that the Black Power movement alienates middle-class white people is that so many white people, and I say this, and I live in a state where blacks almost have to come in contact with white people on a day-to-day basis from childhood because of the scarcity of us, that still white supremacists in the South, like as typified by George Wallace and others, think that they are racially superior to blacks. White liberal middle class think the same thing, only they think their culture is superior, which in essence is saying the same thing. Now, what they don't want to happen, they don't want black people to get together because they know then that society has to give to organized pressure, organized political independent base. It has no choice but to give in to it. Too many white people want, even so-called friends, have their timetable that they want black folks to move on. We have to, of necessity, we have to come to self-determination in order to save ourselves, in order to resurrect ourselves, and perhaps even to save the nation. Now, it is not anti-white. It is anti-white if white people make it so, but it is not the idea or the attitude or the intention. We're not anti-anybody. We haven't got time to hate people. Hate is a false hang-up. We're not interested in hating or even trying to have retribution for past sins. We're talking about building to save 23 million black people in America and make it possible for our kids to grow up whole and healthy and free. I think that many white people are beginning to see this. They're beginning to see that that the nation can't survive with a huge, powerless, stakeless, hopeless, deprived, self-hate-ridden black community in its midst. Many whites are coming to the position that if this condition goes on, that these explosions are going to occur with such regularity that the only repressive force will precipitate a police state, which, as you know, a police state would have more harsh effect on moderate middle-class whites who dwell in middle-class hells in suburbia than it would on black folks, because half of black folks feel we've lost already.
Mr. Lewis, we had to disconnect Mr. McClements because we had a bad line, and just before we take some additional calls, I'd like to pose this question to you. Many of the leaders view the ghettos today as colonies, and since the whites have fled the ghettos and have gone to the suburbs, leaving the ghettos behind, and of course leaving them in kind of sad shape, and now that the new black philosophy is saying that we will now build up the ghettos, that we will make the ghettos habitable places for blacks to live in, is it not possible that the white people should now be kind of happy about the willingness of the blacks to do something about the ghettos?
Well, see, what has happened, as I said before, it's not a condition upon which black people created. You know, when you keep hearing us talk about do you want to build a black nation and all this nonsense, it's not a matter of us building anything. It's already here, you see. All we're talking about is controlling it so as to acquire a base, so as to be meaningful in our society. Now, it is a colony. A colony is that which is being exploited by outsiders, is one definition. Absentee white owners bleed the ghetto dry. We all know this. One reason that they're able to do it isn't all white people's fault either. I maintain that white supremacy put black folks in ghettos, but it's the black man's, our own sense of inferiority and our own sense of lack of negritude, our own sense of lack of purpose and dignity that keeps us there. Now, the all I'm saying is that these ghettos, whether we like it or not, this nation, whether we like it or not, is a racist country. I don't have to have the President's Committee on Civil Disorders tell me that it's white racism. We all black folks know this, that these ghettos are going to be with us 20, 30, 40 years from now, just like ghetto schools are going to be with us 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now. All we're saying is we're going to make it the best ghetto school in the world. We're going to make it the best community in the world. And we're not saying that blacks can't go out to suburbia if they want to or if they can. We're not saying that blacks can't marry white people. We're not trying to deprive anybody of anything. We're not against anything. We're just saying that we accept the condition as it exists. There is no question or doubt that these ghettos are going to be with us until hell freezes over. We intend to make them meaningful.
Mr. Lewis, we have two calls standing by from Fort Worth, Texas, and one from Memphis, Tennessee. So we'll take our Tennessee call. Mr. Hansbrough is hearing night call over WDIA in Memphis. Your call, sir.
Hello. Mr. Lewis?
Yes, Mr. Hansbrough.
This is Robert Hansbrough, and I was listening to you talking about the Negro and the business side of it. And I wanted to know if you think an all-out campaign could possibly be launched against the three major auto industries by the Negro, and say maybe pick up the number four auto industry, which is running, I would say, a bad for us, and maybe make it a black auto industry, really.
Well, Percy, I'm glad you raised that point. To me, instead of sending in nice middle-class committees to talk to the head of big auto concerns and appealing to their Christian morality and historical good faith or ultimate good faith, what if 23 million black people could boycott a major automotive manufacturer?
Right.
We could accomplish a number of things. Initially, we could have a rapidly accelerated program of putting blacks into the plant, drawing down good jobs and managerial positions and so forth. Secondly, we could get dealerships, which we don't have, you see.
Right.
I bet there are five black dealerships in the country where the money is really made. I don't mean putting on a token black salesman to please a local NAACP protest group. I'm talking about a dealership where a bird has a chance to really get up and get on his feet. You know what I'm talking about.
Right.
But see, traditionally, NAACP has favored this conservative approach. We'll go in with our nice Brooks Brothers suits on and knock on the door and have a nice talk. I think Jesse Jackson was completely right, Dell. Who's a beautiful cat, you know.
On
the job he's doing in Operation Breadbasket in Chicago. You know, we've been past the prayer bit and the pleading bit. We've got to start putting some heat on some people, you know. And letting them feel the full weight of our force. But see, we can't do this if our minds are still fouled up, you see.
Now, you take, I have heard often, and what I've heard had it said to me often, you know, well, you can't hurt the big cat, you know, you can't hurt the big industry. And with 24 million Negroes in America, and I'm sure that most of them should realize the fact that we don't control the industry, but since the labor cost and everything is going up so high now, we might not control the industry, but we do control a large margin of their profit, you know. And I would say that if the Negroes went to, say, American Motors instead of the other three, then you would see the other three start lagging in their profits. You see American Motors picking up, along with their stock shares are good at picking up, and then the white man is going to follow you on over there anyway to get some of this bread, you know, and which is going to put the other three farther back behind because he's going to follow the dollar anyway.
I predict this. If we ever get to the point where black power becomes the intrinsic movement in black ghettos across this country, that integration, as we define it, will become a matter of fact within a very few years, because once we're able to think of ourselves as equals and act as equals and act as men, which we haven't acted because we've been emasculated for centuries and because of a lot of other reasons, I predict that once we gain this kind of personal and political and economic equality, that once we start to deal with the white community as equals, then we can start talking about being human beings. But see, once we have a bunch of self-hate-ridden inferiors against a powerful oppressor, as I said before, we just have colonialism. But see, we have not used the best weapon we have, which would be a sustained economic boycott nationally.
Right.
Mr. Lewis, we're going to ask you to hold your point. And Mr. Hansbrough, thank you so much for calling, sir.
Okay.
This is Night Call in New York. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Chester Lewis after station identification. In our city and state and all across the United States, people are talking about trouble, black and white trouble. Some call it racial tension or see poverty as the real problem, or say law and order has given way to anarchy in our streets. Most people agree, at least, that there is a crisis. And we are a people with many unanswered questions. This station believes you deserve to ask your own questions and get some answers, or at least opinions, from people who should know what they're talking about. So we bring you Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show where you ask your questions and express your opinions to leaders such as John Lindsay, Ralph Abernathy, John Gardner, Stokely Carmichael, and Sergeant Shriver. Night Call, the new nationwide radio forum on important issues facing you and the rest of the nation. Night Call, each weeknight. Speak for yourself. Collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Chester Lewis about the changing face of black leadership. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Mr. Chester Lewis, calling in from Wichita, Kansas, and we have our Fort Worth, Texas calls standing by, and we'll take our next call from Mr. Douglas, who is hearing Night Call over KNOK-FM in Fort Worth. Your question, sir. Mr. Douglas has left us. All right, Mr. Ford is hearing Night Call over KNOK-FM, also in Fort Worth. Your question, sir. Mr. Ford?
Yes, I thought you said Mr. Douglas. I'm sorry. Mr. Lewis, I'd like to ask you two questions.
Very good.
The first one, how much participation are you getting from the so-called black middle class to fully participate in our cause? The second question, has there been any serious consideration given to either petitioning or demanding from the United States government that the tax money paid by black people be earmarked specifically for the use by black people in uplifting themselves?
Uh-huh.
And this money to be controlled and directed by black people, because only we know what we need best.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like you to answer those two questions, please.
Well, of course, the black middle class, you see, is going through a real change. Traditionally, the black middle class has been hopeless in terms of the civil rights thrust, because too many black middle class thought that in order to succeed in this society, they had to become carbon copy whites, had to deny their negritude, they had to deny their heritage, and in fact had to hate themselves in order to be relevant. Many black middle class who know that they've got three cars in the garage in white suburbia still know they're still niggers, you see, even with the broadest connotation of the term. I think many of the brothers, I think Whitney Young at the Corps Convention, they said the brothers coming back home, you know, Whitney used to talk about that colored folks ought to be going after Bach and Beethoven because this was the way up. Whitney stopped talking that nonsense because of a new thrust. But also, a lot of black middle class are going through a lot of psychological changes because you know, so many of us thought that by being properly dressed and properly spoken and by being nice and acceptable that white people would think that we were, all of us weren't like those vulgar, welfare-ridden, dirty and disrespectful people in those ghettos on ADC and so forth, and that our own emissariness, our own kind of individual missionary work would catalytically work changes to change the thrust. And, of course, we know this is a complete myth. I have hope the black teachers are meeting in St. Louis next month, which has been one of the hardest groups because they've been so fearful that they might lose their jobs. We're getting black lawyers are becoming, in many instances, more involved. There's still cats who would rather play golf and watch riots on television. But all in all, I think the new black movement is turning a lot of black middle class cats black. And, of course, as a race of people, we need people with skills. You know, you can have good feeling, and you can have esprit de corps and all this, but you need people who have savoir faire, who are able to implement objectives, who have the technical training. On your second question, on having taxes earmarked to help black America, I think it's impractical from this standpoint that all the civil rights decisions that NAACP has won would then be used by certain white segments attacking them on the ground that they were unconstitutional. I'm not so sure that the courts would sustain sustain them, number one, in that it would be based on race and so forth, and therefore this would be unconstitutional. I think that we have to demand out of our government that we've got to demand that if they can spend $300,000 killing one Vietnamese, they can do something about helping some poor beleaguered blacks in these ghettos.
Mr. Ford, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is NICOL in New York, and Mr. Douglas is back with us again from Fort Worth, Texas, where he's hearing NICOL over KNOK-FM. Your question, Mr. Douglas.
Mr. Lewis.
Yes, Mr. Douglas.
Being a former neighbor of yours in Wichita, I have just one question.
What's your first name?
Ken. Ken Douglas.
Ken Douglas.
Yes.
Yeah.
With the surge of ultra-conservatives in the national and local politics, do you think such groups as the John Birch Society, the Minutemen, the Ku Klux Klan, or any other racist group in America could institute or have instituted concentration camps such as Nazi Germany, as some black militants have suggested? And if your answer is no, would you please explain?
Well, let me say this. There again, I don't dwell on the Birch Society or the Ku Klux Klan or the Communist Party or the Minutemen who are right over here in Kansas City, Missouri, who take target practice out on the Missouri Hills. To me, these are scapegoats. These people don't run this society. These people aren't the mayors, the governors, the board of commissioners, the presidents. The people who run this society are the moderate liberals in this nation. These are the ones who decide whether or not a highway comes to a black ghetto and throws literally thousands of blacks out into the streets. These are the people who decide whether or not a black professional becomes a manager or remains a water boy. And therefore, these kinds of people I'm not even fearful of, although, of course, the establishment continually raises the spectrum so we can divert our attention away from where we ought to be. I don't even believe in beating the police brutality whip because white policemen aren't the cause, they're agents of the structure. They'll change when the structure tells them to change. And I hate to see people get off on tangents, which we've been doing for years. Instead of going after the central source, they get us off on some peripheral thing. I would say this, that today white people are so panicky in this nation that if there are other explosions and rebellions like in Watts, in Newark, and in Detroit, say, for instance, between now and September, that these are repeated, say, in 20 or 25 cities across this country, I would predict that a great number of black people will be in concentration camps. I think that there's enough panic, enough fear among white people for them to completely deny their own constitutional liberties in this panic stage. It might even precipitate the election of Governor Wallace under these circumstances that this happened between now and November. As you know, the alienated cats in the hardcore ghettos, all of them feel from nation to nation, rightly or wrongly, that the man, as they call him, is working out a final solution for black folks. And they believe this sincerely, and there's no need to, as you know, if you're connected with it or have any association with it.
Mr. Douglas, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dunlop is hearing Night Call over WRHC in Jacksonville, Florida. Your question, Mr. Dunlop.
I'm coming on this. I live in Jacksonville, Florida, way in the southern part of the state. The white men in the southern states, as a rule, are helping we colored people down here. They're helping us. In every instance, they're helping us. But in my race, there's a whole lot of my people in my race who want help and don't want to help themselves. I'm in Jacksonville, Florida here, and I see how condition goes. There's a lot of white people, hundreds of white people, as anxious to help the colored people.
When you say help,
but the colored people ain't helping themselves as a rule.
When you say help, what do you mean, sir?
Mr. Dunlap?
What do you mean by help?
Did you hear the question, sir?
Well, you say that a lot of white people in Jacksonville are anxious to help Negroes.
They help us, and every instant they can, they help us.
I know, but in what way would you say?
Mm-hmm.
What way do they help you?
Why do they help you?
What kind of help do you have reference to?
They open jobs for you, they give you anything you go to them for, what more do you want?
I see. How many blacks do you have in Jacksonville who are managers in companies and plants?
Well, in
and companies in Blaine. I don't know about some of the managers in Jacksonville, but I feel as though in Jacksonville that we need to open some stores ourselves.
I see.
Or some places of business. We got a lot of colored people in Jacksonville with thousands and thousands of dollars. They're just keeping it in the bank. They're not invested like the Afro Insurance and different places like that.
I think you have a very strong point. Of course, see, this is the reason why I say that people who say that we need green power. See, green power can't be acquired unless you first cure the crisis of racial identity. Once we find out who we are, once we stop trying to be white, once we accept the fact that we're black and beautiful, once we get rid of all these psychological hang-ups, then we can start to move together, you see, to build economic bases and political bases, independent bases of power. What you're saying is absolutely correct, but see, as long as we're brainwashed, as long as we think if something is black-owned and black-run, it's inferior, it's going to go bankrupt, or somebody's going to walk off with the money. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Then we're not going to do business with each other, you see. And this is the reason why there's such emphasis on racial pride and racial...
Well, see, racial pride starts with us ourselves.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
We got a certain group of people in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
We got a poor group of people. I mean the poor class.
Mm-hmm.
And we got another class, the sorority class.
Well, even one class of black people, that's poor and upper poor. Ain't no
Mr. Dunlap, thank you for calling, sir.
All right.
Thank you so much. Mr. Lewis, we want to thank you for being our guest tonight on Night Call. Thank you so much. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, The Changing Face of Black Leadership, Part 3, has Core Gone Tom, with Roy Innes, Acting Director of the Congress for Racial Equality. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, and National Urban Coalition. We'll be right back.